All right, so as Joe mentioned, my name is Jeanette Herbers. I'm at Villanova, and co-presenting with me today is my friend and colleague, Laura Wallace. So many of you know Laura from her work. She worked with the Maternity Care Coalition for a long time, and since then, she got her doctorate in school psych at Lehigh. She's been doing some work with University of Delaware. And then now she's currently in a role with the American Institutes of Research. So Laura worked with me and several of my graduate students and undergraduate students at Villanova on the paper that we're going to be presenting today. And I also want to mention that the lead author of this work is McKenna Halverson. She is currently a graduate student at University of Delaware in Human Development and Family Studies, but she was a student with me at Villanova, and she would have loved to be here with all of you today, but she's taking a really crucial oral examination for her doctoral program right now. So let's all send some good wishes her way. All right, so Laura and I are going to share about this work and our paper, and then we have two wonderful women who are going to share some reflections on the work and contribute some thoughts and questions based on their own work in the area and their own perspectives. So after Laura and I present our presentation, Katie Volk will respond. Katie is a researcher and child development expert in the Boston area. She's been working in the field of homelessness for 20 plus years. She's worked with Carmela DeCandia and the Ellen Bassick's team at C4. And she currently has her own consulting group. She's also a recent doctoral recipient and does some teaching as well. So she does everything and knows everything and is a good friend and colleague of mine. So I'm thrilled to have her with us today. And after Katie's reflections, we'll hear from Melissa Johnson, who I'm sure almost all of you know well and love. She's the social work trainer for the Homeless Health Initiative at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And she's going to be sharing her thoughts and reflections on our presentations and the topic. Based on her work on the ground and her experience working with shelters and families for many years. So I'd like to start by presenting the framework that I use in my work, in my research with children and families experiencing homelessness. And I come to all of my work with this developmental science framework of what we call risk and resilience in development. Risk and resilience is founded in the idea that children develop, and they develop not just because they are human children, but because they are in context. So, child development all takes place in the context of family and family functioning. And families are embedded within neighborhoods and communities, and their neighborhoods and communities are embedded in these broader social, economic, and political conditions. So, we understand that how children develop is consistently influenced by what's going on in those other contexts, and that what is happening at these different levels of experience are all a part of the story of how children learn and grow. So, in risk and resilience, we want to understand at all these different levels what are the factors that we worry about, because we know based on research and experience that these are factors that can harm development. We call them risk factors. Sometimes people talk about ACEs or adverse childhood experiences. People talk about trauma. People talk about social disadvantage, discrimination, and all of these types of things fit with this concept of risk factors, because we know that when these risks are present in the lives of children, there's a greater likelihood that children are going to struggle with some of their development. But we also know that not all children who experience risk have serious problems, and that in fact, many children can cope and can manage and can overcome challenges in their lives. And that's where we seek to understand, okay, what makes that possible, right? Because we know that risks are a threat. And so if we can understand what enables many children to cope successfully with those threats and challenges, we have the potential to learn from that and approach families that are struggling and children who are struggling with better ideas about how to help and support them. So that's what risk and resilience is, big picture, big ideas. And then in my work and in collaboration with the people in this conference, we try to apply this to more specific circumstances and think about how to use this information we learn from the research to support programs and services and best practices. Just a little bit more briefly about this idea of risk and resilience. And now I'm specifically going to focus on early childhood. So focusing on children from birth to about age 5. This is just a short list of some of the key factors that we think about in risk and resilience for early childhood. So in the red column here, you see things that we consider to be risk factors or threats or ACEs. Again, lots of different terms that generally mean these things that when they're present, they indicate a greater risk for poor outcomes for children. And we know based on our work with family homelessness that most of the things on this list are things that are more likely to be in the lives of children who are unstably housed. So things like family conflict, sometimes neglect, caregiver depression, chaotic environments. So when families are residentially unstable, there's less consistency in the environments of the family. And we know that many of the caregivers of young children who experience homelessness have had traumatic experiences in their own lives previously and sometimes currently. And also that sometimes when children experience homelessness, this separates them from caregivers. Could be their father or their grandparents or other care providers. When families are residentially unstable, they often have to move away from supportive people. And some children may also be separated from their primary caregivers at different times. So again, these are all known to be potent risks for children, and these are all things that can come along with family homelessness. Now, not every family that experiences homelessness has these issues, but we do see these issues more often in the family homelessness as a group. So we also have some evidence, not enough. We need more research on early childhood development in the context of family homelessness. There really just truly is not much, especially for those 0 to 3s. We know almost nothing about how the 0 to 3 children are doing from the standpoint of research literature. We know a lot from our experience and our work, but it's not reflected in the research literature. But from what we do know from the work that has been done, we know that children who experience family homelessness are at risk for motor delays. They're at risk for cognitive delays or difficulties with their thinking and learning skills. We know that children who experience family homelessness are more likely to show problems in their attachment relationships with caregivers. And we again, we have ideas and we have hypotheses that these other factors, like children's ability to explore and be engaged in the world and their language growth, is also impacted negatively by the context of poverty and specifically housing instability. So when we think about resilience, this blue column, this is what we want to see, right? A child who is resilient and functioning well and showing healthy development is going to be doing all these things just like their same age peers. And these threats can interfere with the likelihood that these things appear. So that's why, again, we want to focus on this green column in the middle, which tells us what are the factors that can strengthen healthy child development, that can support and that can bolster children and families in coping successfully when risks occur. So again, our higher calling here in the risk and resilience research and in applying that research is to say, okay, whenever possible, can we put a stop to these threats and these adverse experiences? Because that would be the most obvious way, right? Is if we could just prevent these things from happening in the first place. But we also understand that you can't prevent all threats and ACEs. And so when they do occur, and even when they don't, right? How can we make these strengths and assets stronger and build them and support them and grow them, provide them when they don't exist, or recognize them when they do, right? And enable families when families have access to strengths and assets, don't get in their way, right? Let them utilize those strengths and assets in the way that's working well for them. So with that sort of big picture framework, I'm going to talk specifically about this paper that was recently published. This is not a paper that's freely available online. I wish it were, but if you would like a copy of the paper, just email me and I will send it right over to you anytime. So please feel free to reach out and I will share that. So this, I've also wanted to mention too that we've shared some of the findings that are represented in this paper with this group before. The academic publication process can be frustratingly slow, and we don't always want to wait before we talk to this group. So some of you will have heard some of this before, but we're sharing new things as well. So in this paper, my colleagues and I in our research group were on pursuing a project to think about what could we do to bolster the resources within shelter spaces for families experiencing homelessness. And we had some ideas about what we thought would be valuable, but we wanted to hear more from shelter providers themselves and get their perspectives to see if we were on the right track and maybe if there were things that we weren't thinking about that we should focus our energy on. So we designed a survey for shelter staff, and we were actually, this was in the end of 2019 when we got serious about planning this. And we originally thought, because if we work primarily in the Philly area, we thought, oh, we'll just survey all the shelter staff in the Philly area about their programs. And we'll go out and we'll meet with them and we'll interview them and hear everything they have to say. And then, of course, March 2020 came along and everything shut down. And we realized that we weren't going to be sitting face to face with anybody, that this was going to be done remotely. So we decided to broaden it and do a survey across the country with shelter providers. And of course, we also at the last minute added in some questions about COVID, which I'm not going to talk about a lot today, but if people are interested, we could share a little bit about that too. So we ended up with a nice sample that I'll describe in just a moment. But these were our target questions. We were thinking about, again, the very youngest children who stay in shelter and thinking about living in the shelter space at this very early crucial point of development and thinking about what children need most for healthy development and to what extent do they have those needs met in these spaces. So we wanted to ask shelter providers, do they have play spaces for young children? And if so, what are those spaces like? We wanted to know if there's programming in shelters that supports positive parenting and parent-child relationships. Because again, if you back to that threats and assets chart, so much of child well-being depends on caregiver well-being. And then we wanted to ask specifically if shelter staff felt like they were knowledgeable about early childhood development. Just did they have that background, that training, that those facts about how early child development works at their disposal when they're interacting with children and families on a regular basis? And then finally, our ultimate goal was to think about developing trainings to meet some needs. So we wanted the staff to tell us what trainings they were interested in. So I have shared a little bit about these questions 3 and 4 in the past, and I'm going to review that and add a bit more information now. And then I'm going to turn the presentation over to Laura, who will share what we learned about the first two questions. So we're going to start with the last two here and then come back to the first two. For our survey, McKenna Halverson took the lead in phone surveys. So she recruited through the COCs across the entire country, contacting COCs directly and saying, please share our information about our study to any shelters within your COC, and anyone who would be willing to have a phone call with us and answer some questions about their work in shelter spaces. And we focus primarily on the staff who work most closely in a role involving children. So, those of you familiar with the shelter systems know that, we have some very small shelters that might have a complete total of three staff, and they all do everything, right? And then we have some very large shelters that have very large staff, and there might be some who are have roles specifically, titles and roles specifically related to child programming or early childhood or even just families, because some shelter programs are not focused only on family. They also house single adults and other youth and other populations. So we wanted to have with our interviews, whoever was the staff at any particular shelter who was most closely working with a role of young children. And we kind of let people define that. And also, if we couldn't get that, we took who we could get. The interviews took place between August of 2020 and April of 2021. So we were in the midst of the COVID pandemic, but we were asking broadly, not only about right now, but also about prior. And we managed to include shelters from all 10 of the HUD regions. And we had 70 individuals from 64 different shelters. So in our data analysis, we just looked at one person from each shelter so that we wouldn't have a pair of people from one place giving us similar answers. So in total, we have 64 responses that represent 64 different family shelters across the country. Here's how well we did with across the country. We were pretty pleased that we were able to get a good spread. So all of the states that are blue here, we had at least one respondent from that state. And we covered a pretty good coverage of different geographical regions. Our respondents were mostly in shelters that were located in urban areas. And then we had also a good proportion of shelter respondents who were in suburban areas, and a very small number of people who were had shelters located in rural areas, are harder to reach. They're under-resourced. And also my understanding is that there aren't many, right? In rural areas, they don't often have shelters in those areas. They might use other programs or other types of resources, like motels to house families in need of housing. On average, the shelters that were included in the survey had 65 beds in their spaces, but there was a broad range, like I mentioned before. We have tiny shelters with a total of 9 beds, and we have larger spaces with up to 400 beds represented in our sample. We did include only shelters that house families. So if a shelter did not have families staying with them, well, they were not included in the survey. And so at the time that we talked with these staff, they reported having on anywhere from 0 to 49 children under the age of 5 staying with them. Again, these were all places that would take a child under 5. They just didn't necessarily have one the day that we talked to them. And on average, the shelters had about 10 children under 5 living in them. The staff themselves also represented a range. So we had staff telling us on average they had about 16 years of experience working with children and families experiencing homelessness, but we had anywhere from 2 to 41 years of experience represented. Some of them had only been at that particular shelter for a very short time, but they all of them had at least 2 years of experience working in some capacity with families experiencing. You can see we had a range of different incomes represented in our respondents. We also had less of a range in race ethnicity. The most of our respondents reported that they identified their race ethnicity as white. with smaller proportions of other groups in the sample. Again, in their shelter roles, we were looking for the person who was most knowledgeable about child and family services, and we ended up getting actually about half of them were in executive roles. Again, at a very small shelter, executive role still means a person who's doing all the things every day, right? But often we were talking to shelter directors or someone in a leadership role. Otherwise, we were talking to a lot of case managers and then some people who describe titles like child and family services. Finally, we found that most of our respondents had bachelor's degrees as their highest level of education. Some had graduate professional degrees, and some had a high school degree as their highest level of achievement. So again, I've presented to this group before on the training needs portion. So I'm going to go through this fairly quickly, but this was one of our emphases because of our goal of hoping to try and meet some of these training needs and work. So to find out our question about whether shelter staff were knowledgeable about early childhood development, we asked our respondents the following questions. So we asked them about how much they felt they knew how to help caregivers bond, when children should meet milestones, how to support safe sleep, discipline, and also just generally where to find information. So when you have a question about a very young child, do you know where to look? And we asked respondents to tell us if they felt they knew these things, not at all, somewhat, fairly well, or very well. Then we also, because we felt like we were probably talking to the most knowledgeable person in that shelter, based on the roles we were recruiting for, we also asked them to tell us their perspective on what their coworkers or colleagues know. So we asked the same questions about their perspective of how well do other staff know about these areas. What we found is represented on this bar chart. So again, they had, response options from 1 to 4. And the blue bars represent what the staff told us about themselves, and the yellow bars represent what the staff told us about their coworkers or the other staff in their organizations. So what you can see is first, as we expected, the staff themselves reported that they were somewhat more knowledgeable than their colleagues. Again, not surprising because we were specifically recruiting the person that would be in that role. But also interestingly, they're not topping it out, right? They're not all saying that they're experts on all these things, and they're all acknowledging that there's probably more they could know about most of these areas. And similarly, with their colleagues, there's more that their colleagues could know to be more knowledgeable about childhood development. So next, we asked them what training needs or interests in early childhood development would they identify, and here's how we asked about that. Our questions were, what questions about young children come up a lot in the work that you do? What are the top three child development areas that would be most important for you to learn about? And what are the top three areas that would be most important for other staff to learn about? So giving them a chance to tell us what would you like to know more, and also what need do you see among your colleagues in your work? So we got open-ended responses to these questions. We just wanted to hear it in their own words. And then we reviewed all of these open-ended responses and put them into categories to see what topics were coming up most frequently. So what we found is that the three top things that shelter staff thought they would benefit from learning more about were parenting, impacts of trauma and traumatic stress on families, and children's social emotional development. And then you could see a lot of them also mentioned things like motor development, speech and language, cognitive, which is anything related to learning, right, and problem solving, and some of those like pre-academic skills that children are developing. So there was a lot of interest in some specific topics, but also just generally how children grow and how children develop and what is expected, what's normal. And also related to that, when should somebody be concerned, or when should someone suggest that maybe a family talk to their pediatrician or early intervention, or just get more information about how the child is doing. So again, the last time I spoke to this group, we shared some of this information and we were getting ready to launch a training that we had developed. So this is a quick aside. This is not part of the paper, but since I talked to you about this before, I wanted to just take the opportunity to give a brief update. Based on this survey and the information we were learning, we were developing a training series of workshops for shelter staff. We called it KEDS, which stands for Knowledge of Early Child Development in Shelter. And we designed this series of workshops to be an in-person group where shelter staff could gather and could engage in some discussions and activities to learn about these topics that had been identified as valuable training topics. We took a strengths-based and trauma-informed approach. And we based our information on, being able to have a lot of discussion and active involvement from our participants. So we had last May, we finished our first trial of the series. I'm going to skip this quickly. But I just want to share, this is a picture of our first group who tried out our workshop series and generally gave us positive feedback about that. We learned a lot from doing it one time, and we're hoping to continue to improve on this workshop series and provide it again, hopefully in the area and maybe beyond once we feel like we've really got it. So again, just wanted to share the update that's something we're actively working on and that we hope to continue to do locally. But back to the paper and the survey. So what I'm going to do now is turn this over to Laura so that she can talk about some of the other research questions and the data that we haven't shared with this group before that's represented in our publication. So Laura, I'll try and manage the slides, but just tell me if you advance.
Thank you, Jeanette. Okay, so kind of the two sections that I'm gonna get to talk about are the questions we asked around shelter spaces for young children, and then also curricula potentially used in shelter. And so on the survey, I'm good to advance, Jeanette. We specifically asked our respondents, does your shelter have a space other than resident rooms that is designed for children ages 0 to 3 and their families? And we purposely kept that very open-ended because we had a feeling that shelters had very different spaces, maybe to serve this purpose. If they said yes, we asked them to describe that space. And then we followed up by asking them, what are some barriers to the use of the space by families? And when we look across all of the responses that we had, we see that a lot of shelters really did report that they had a player activity space, right? So we have 50% reporting that there is a space and only 12.5% reporting that there is no space. And we see a variability in the types of spaces that are potentially in these environments. So some are outdoors, some are education centers, some are nested within an adult space. Other folks reported having a childcare or a nursery within their shelter. So lots of variability in what we were seeing, but we were seeing that those spaces are available. And so on the next slide, which I do apologize, Jeanette, for the animation, we pulled some direct quotes to kind of show some of the variability we were seeing. So this person who spoke with us had a really robust space, right? They had a three-story child development program, and the first floor had infants and toddlers, and they had childcare there. And it sounds like a really great program with therapy rooms and breastfeeding places and classrooms. And in the second floor, they moved up in age, they moved up, and they had a preschool program and more therapy rooms for families and child spaces for OT, PT. They had a medical and dental clinic. They came to the childcare setting once a week. And then, as the kids got older, that third floor was dedicated to a school-age program where there are case managers and clinicians, and their offices were housed there. They had an after-school room and a library space and a teen space and a kitchen. So really full program at this shelter. We had variable responses. So some of the other things we heard, we have a resource room where parents can use computers and children have room to play, right? So one of those nested spaces almost. We have a large room for workshops where parents can be there and can have informational sessions where High school and college students play with the children. It's a little bit different. We have, another space where they're like, this is our 20 foot by 20 foot space. And we have, it's a child safety gate. We have chairs for moms who are breastfeeding, kids books, Legos, dollhouses. So I really love seeing these quotes all together because we see how variable these spaces really are. So once we heard about the spaces that folks had, our respondents, we asked about some of the challenges. And I think you won't be surprised by these challenges, right? So one shelter shared that sometimes we don't have appropriate stuff when they come in and we have to go shopping. When they leave, if the kids have become attached to something, we let them take it. And that really resonates with me because we're seeing shelters try it, like meeting the needs of the families and what the kids needs in time and space. But right, if you let some of your materials go, you have to keep replacing them, which is a challenge too. Some other challenges include what to do when shelters have these nested or shared spaces. So this respondent said that their space was always open, but there were barriers because sometimes it must have been near another adult room because families who didn't have kids wanted to watch TV and they would complain the kids were too loud, right? So they had a shared space and they wished they had a whole separate area. Also challenges just about how to access spaces. So this respondent shared that they have spaces available for families, but in order to access those spaces and not just be in the general lounge, families had to sign up for programs and actually go to those programs to attend those, to get into those spaces, which I'll talk about towards the end. We can imagine that could be, it's a barrier for families, kids, and the shelter staff as well. This quote, I think, is really unique when we think about shelters that may have childcare spaces, that parents' past trauma makes them fearful to leave their children, right? And what happens when you have a parent or a caregiver who experienced their own trauma and they are still trying to heal from that trauma or carry that trauma? And now they have really young children, like infants and toddlers, who, when we ask them to put them in childcare, we're asking them to put their nonverbal children into spaces where they're not. And how do we build that trust? And what is that, those really large barriers around that? So, sometimes just having, it's great to have a childcare space, but that won't solve everything. And our last comment, which I think is, we heard quite a bit and we've heard in different contexts, is yes, there are times when the childcare space is closed because there simply are no staff to keep it open or no volunteers available to maintain it, right? So it seems like, we've heard, yes, there are spaces, but they're not without their challenges. And some of them are really big challenges. All right, so our next set of questions, we asked our respondents if they had parenting classes or workshops focused on parenting young children. Again, we were really purposefully open-ended and said, like, what are you doing? Can you tell us? And then if they said yes, we asked them the names of those groups and then asked them to describe what the groups are like. So what we were trying to get at was, are they homegrown programs? Are they using curricula? What is going on? And so we were able to break it down into four categories, our responses. And the first was none, right? So they are not having parenting programs in shelters, 34%. And again, these are shelters, as Jeanette described, that could at any time take a child under five. They're not having parenting programs available. Our next category are homegrown programs. So these were situations where our participants told us, yes, we have a program, and they went on to describe a parenting program that didn't seem to follow a curricula, and it just seemed to be really free, kind of flowing. The third category is, the third and fourth, we had an even split with structured programs and evidence-based. And so I think, evidence-based right? They're using a curriculum, they're following those steps, there's some type of training. Very kind of boop, 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 boop pathway to this curriculum. Where structured, we see the shelter has a plan, the parent educator, whoever is doing this training, has a plan for what they're teaching in these sessions, but they're not necessarily following one single curriculum. Maybe they're pulling different pieces from different curricula, they're using different resources, community or online resources to support parents. So we're seeing, there are shelters who we talked to who didn't have a parenting program. The vast majority had a homegrown, where we can think about they were kind of piecemeal putting together what they were doing. And so, like before, I have some quotes for you just to think about the broad range of what we heard. So our first, we had a participant share that they were using Circle of Security, which we know is evidence-based, and that prior to COVID, they had an awesome program. They had a certified individual who would come in once a week, and the parent would come to the free space where they were shown videos and lectures. And I also like this quote because it does highlight, like, there were, regardless of the challenges that are usually happening in these spaces to engage and support parents and families with young children, then we had COVID too. And I know Jeanette said she'd be happy. We could talk more about that if there were questions. Building strong families. This was a shelter that brought in a University of Missouri extension, and it really depended on who was in the shelter at that time, right? So they had a facilitator who went to a really structured 3 to 4 day training. There was a book with different modules, right? So it was a structured program, it was lined out for the sequence of lessons or topics to be discussed upon. The third one, this always, the title, this always makes me chuckle, right? Parenting in Pajamas. And they used a curriculum called Positive Discipline. And they were weekly parenting groups, but they purposefully did them at night when kids were asleep, and they were in bed, and they had parents come in their pajamas, and they wanted them to be comfortable, right? So they could come at night when maybe they're more relaxed. And in addition to that, they were having a group once a month focused on ACEs, resilience, growth mindset. And before I talk about our last one, right, just to think about the first three. So we're seeing different curriculum, different approaches, right? Even different contexts, right? The Circle of Security, how that training was going on in that shelter was so different in parenting in pajamas, right? If you're having a visitor, a certified individual come once a week to the shelter and there are lectures and it's very structured, versus parenting in pajamas where parents came down and they building an environment where maybe people are a little more relaxed. And then our last example is probably the least structured, where they shared that they did monthly life skill classes, where life skill worker comes in monthly, but these classes are not always parenting based. They cover budgeting, how to quit smoking, et cetera, and some parenting, but they shared that it was hard to get people to show up. And so you can imagine in this type of parenting program, you may also have other folks staying at the shelter who are coming to some of these sessions, right? Because budgeting and how to quit smoking just aren't related to parenting. And so again, what is that environment like when you have other people who are staying at shelter working together in these sessions versus just parents? So really wide range of both curricula and how they were used. All right, and I'm grateful to Jeanette, I get to do this last little section, which I think arguably is the most fun, right? So I get to share with you kind of where I am now after thinking about this paper, our thoughts and reflections and questions. And I'm a researcher, so I wouldn't be a good researcher if I didn't leave you with more questions than you had when you got here. So I'm going to try really hard to do that. And I also want us to think a little bit broadly about other contexts where we can think about these challenges. So the first thing that I've spent some time thinking about is how do we share resources and ideas across programs? And this seems like a ridiculous question, right? Like here we are in this conference, Joe and Malkia have brought us together. And I have to say, The children's work group is really unique, and we are so lucky to have this in Philadelphia, but this does not happen everywhere, right? And so when we were doing some piloting for the kids program that Jeanette talked about, we were working with shelter staff from more rural and suburban areas and other parts of the country. And they were so grateful just to be in the same Zoom room as other providers. They were, of course, happy for our training, but just to be able to talk to other people doing the same work as them, and they exchanged emails. And in that moment, it really clicked that how isolating this type of work can be if you don't have a conference like this, right? To be able to meet with other people. And then on top of that, if you don't have a safe space, and then you have all the stressors of work that everybody has, right? Like, is there enough time? Is there enough resources? Geography, is the next shelter, you know, 4 hours away? How do we do this in a really meaningful way? And I think that's something we're still thinking about too, especially when we think about the KEDS training. How do we bring people together in really meaningful ways? The next area I've been really thinking about is, you know, when we have curriculum, right? And this is a question that might get me kicked out, right? Kicked out of the room as a researcher. Is evidence-based always best? I don't know, right? So I've worked in the home visiting space for a long time, and we have those evidence-based home visiting programs, and that's great, but we're having a hard time replicating them, right? And why is that? And so we know that evidence-based curriculums are research-backed and they've been tested and all that good stuff, but in what context were they tested and with what people? And I think it's clear that if we're implementing a curriculum or a training with parents, we want it to have some structure so they know what to expect, right? And we want to be able to keep families engaged. What happens when a curriculum is too structured, right? What happens when you can't meet the needs of families where they are because there's no space in the curriculum and you have to keep going from lesson A to B to C to D to D.1, right? Is that always helpful or sensitive to the folks that you're working with? And then on top of that, what happens when the curriculum that you're using don't come in the languages that you need, which is a really big challenge, a huge challenge? And what happens when they're cost prohibitive, which is also a real problem? And so I think I've been thinking a lot about there's this movement in home visiting towards precision home visiting, which is based on precision medicine, which is the idea that for a really long time, when we try and treat things in medicine or in home visiting, when we work with families, we try and do, you know, the average services that'll meet the average needs of families, right? Like we try and hit right down the middle. And it's not working so great, right? No one's really average. We can't meet everyone's needs. And so thinking about why do families come to us, whether it's in home visiting or in the shelter context, or child welfare, and what do they need? And how can we tailor what we're doing to support them? And that's kind of a tricky space to be in when you're an evidence-based curriculum, right? So how do we marry those two thoughts together? And maybe people have thoughts, right? I'm sure there are smarter people than me in this room who have had thoughts about this. And I'm interested to hear those too. So, you know, thinking about them, we've talked about curriculum and resources. How, when we have new programs or interventions, how do we implement these programs or interventions responsibly? And I think kind of what sparked this thought in me is we got those responses about childcare spaces, which are so great to have, but what happens when they can't be open because there's not enough resources to staff them, right? How do we make these great programs work while supporting the staff who are doing them? And so when I think about the word responsibly, right? How do we do these programs or interventions responsibly? How are we able to implement them without putting extra burdens on the staff who are working in the shelter or families, right? So There was one shelter that shared they had a space, but families could only get to it if they signed up for programming. But then what happens if the programming is at a time when parents are working, or they can't get there, or the program's full, right? And I think, I've spent a lot of time thinking about, I help write grants for different programs, and I think a lot about, okay, grants are great, and we're going to have money, and this is great, but what's the aftermath of that? We bring in this great intervention or space or resource. Is it time limited? What do we do when now we have this great thing that we want to keep, but we no longer have the money to fund it? Or what are the deliverables that then the organization or the drug service people I'm working with, what do they have to do to keep getting this money? What is their reporting? And is it increasing the burden of their workload? And I did promise some policy thoughts, and I'm thinking a lot about this right now with the American, the ARPA, the recovery dollars and stabilization grants, right? Where we had a big influx of money to childcare providers to be able to support their childcare programs and families and kids and workers through COVID. And if you've been in this space, which I know everyone has been, you'd know before COVID, we needed money to support childcare, right? Like baseline, we need money to support childcare. And then we get this one-time grant of all this money, and now it's gone. And what happens next? And this keeps me up at night, right? Like, what happens next? And where did that money go? Did that money flow to some of our cities and regions of this country where families and children are living in the greatest context of risk? And what happens now when those dollars dry up? Did we give families access to childcare and childcare workers meaningful minimum wage to now just stop it and pull it back? And so are we giving opportunities and taking them away? And what is the equity of that? And I think right now that is a very real thought that I'm thinking of when we hear every day in the news about childcare programs that or home childcare providers that were able to pay themselves a salary for their first time ever with these dollars, and now they're gone. And so I'm always happy to talk about that with folks who want to brainstorm. And my last one on this page, right, and thinking about all these things like resources and curriculum and interventions, and where is the balance, right? So we know, as Jeanette really shared with us, that in the shelter context, in home visiting, in children who come to child and families involved with child welfare, we have families who are experiencing real life threats and risks in that moment, and we want to support them. And how do we balance that support for these crises that are happening, but also taking this opportunity in this window of time to help foster development during this critical window? And how do you balance that? And is it always reasonable to even try to balance that? If you have a family, and I'm thinking specifically about home visiting, who is struggling to pay their electric bills or to find food, is that the time and space to say, like, hey, let's talk about your child's developmental milestones? I don't know. Is it when people are trying to survive and really meet their base needs? I don't know. But then we also don't want to miss that opportunity. And I have seen home visitors who are so good at this. They are really good at this, to be able to hold the space for what parents and families are going through, but also being able to support this development, whether it's attachment or breastfeeding or milestones. And I don't know how we bottle that, right? Do we just have direct service staff who are innately good at this? How do we teach that? Can we teach that? I don't know, right? When do we know when to be out of balance? When do we try? And so I think about that a lot too. And I have just one more big thought. And if we ever, you ever worked, we talked before when I was in Philly, you may have heard me talk about this, but in a perfect world, right? I'm going to really simplify this. If we thought about how we could build the best case manager or the best family service provider or the best home visitor or the best children youth services worker, right? Like if we could give them everything they would need for their job. Like we were building like one of these potato head people, right? Like you're putting the parts in and putting the knowledge, right? What skills would we need to give them? And like honestly, I don't even know. And I've been thinking about this example forever, right? So when we think about these contexts in which these individuals work, they need so many skills, right? Legal aid, health support, child development, parenting, safety, newborn, toddler, infant, adolescent safety, financial expertise, how to fill out all that ridiculous legal paperwork, to be a social worker, how to provide trauma, informed care and support, to be a marriage therapist, how to address domestic violence, to be a translator. It goes on and on and on. I know that's not everything. It is so much, right? So in the context of my like potato head people here, they would need 17 eyes and 42 ears and 57 hands and 17 feet, right? And so how do we support direct service staff when they do so much? And how do we keep this in mind when we're sharing new skills with them and we're asking them to do new things, right? Like we saw how the providers rated themselves on child development knowledge. And if we wanted to give them more, how do we balance that with everything that they're doing? And how much is too much? And I don't know the answer to that. Like, where is the balance? Do we want them to be experts? Do we want them to be liaisons, right? And this doesn't even take into account that we know direct service staff, every day there's a new challenge where they're having to figure out which potato head hat or feet or eyes or legs to put on in that moment. And how do we support our staff who are doing so much in areas where our families are really at the greatest risk and we really want to support them with what they need? And so I'll leave you with this potato image, the potato people, and your thoughts. And thank you for listening to me share my ramblings in my head.
Thank you, Laura. All right, so I will send it straight over to Katie, who has also been thinking about all of these things and has some things to share from her own work and her own experience. I'll stop my share, Katie. You should be able to share your screen.
Okay, terrific. Thank you so much, Jeanette and Laura. That was so interesting. I had like a little, I have like a, you can't see it here, but I have now a full page of notes everywhere from all of that. And I think what I might do is take some time just to go through that and just respond to some of what you're saying, just in the interest of furthering the conversation. And then if there's still time, I'll present a little bit of some of the research that I've done here in the Boston area. So I think this risk and protective framework, which I use in my research as well, is really something that we as a field, as a child development field, that's very familiar. As a homelessness field, I think we're still sort of figuring out what that looks like, or not what it looks like, but how to use it and how to have a conversation about it and how to talk with staff about it. I also think it lends itself really well to an ecological model where we've got this child in the center, this family in the center, and then there's their broader family context and their environment and the staff that is influencing them. And it's all about that context. Like all of Laura and Jeanette's questions, I think, are contextual ones. And so to me, that's exciting and also very complicated. I love the potato head analogy. And so a few things struck me when you were talking. One is just how little we know about the family homelessness workforce and staff. It's actually very hard to find research that documents anything about the staff, especially that's current. And so to start to actually document what that looks like and think about what is the training, who do these folks need to be, who are they, where does that, all of that is very, very new, and I'm really excited to have some of that. It's striking to me too, I think, just the wide range. And I've worked with big programs in different parts of the country where they have a child services person and they've got the resources to bring in training for their case managers. And I've worked with the tiny shelters where they have two people and they're running around all the time. And maybe they read a book or listen to something on the way to work, or, and that's their child development training. It's 15 minutes in their commute when they flip on a podcast, and then they go in and it's, you know, once more into the fray. There's a huge need to understand child development, right? A huge need to understand that. And I also think, how we package that or frame that can look really different depending on context. It's really striking to me from your research that 44% of the programs or the parenting interventions are homegrown. And what I wonder about is who's developing those? Is it also the 50% who have some child development training, or is it some folks with some knowledge and some kind of good intentions that sort of cobble something together? And we just don't know. And I think figuring that out, because it's not just parenting that folks may need help with. They may not need help with parenting, but it might be child development knowledge. It might be their own self-care, right? There's a huge body of research that shows that parental reflective capacity, our ability to reflect in the moment and change our practice or be responsive to, you know, I always talk about, you've got to parent the kid in front of you, and how do you reflect on that? And there's a large body of research that talks about parental reflective capacity is one of the best indicators of strong relationships and strong parenting. So do we cultivate that as part of our parenting efforts, or do we focus more on the milestones and the verbal development and things like that? Or do we just really zero in on play, period? And that transitions me to the environment. And I want to take a step back, actually, as we think about play. I think a lot about play, by the way, like every day, a lot about play. Play is a human right. It is codified in the UN Rights of the Child as a right for all children. And yet in shelters, we see this really unevenness in play. I think it's really interesting to start documenting what shelters have for play spaces. Do they exist? And then the next step, I think, would be, what do they look like? And if you can only access them from 3:30 to 5 on alternate Tuesdays and Thursdays, which I have seen, or do they, you know, that makes a difference. And play for a one-year-old in a safe kind of way looks really different than play for a four-year-old or a five-year-old. And thinking about, like, do we focus in on that as not as a field, but as a conference, as a cohort of people concerned about kids? Because there are ways to think about low resource materials and clean floor spaces where you can, for a one-year-old, you can have a cordoned off area and put that one-year-old on the floor with a few interesting things that can look like a spoon and some Tupperware and like a fluffy stuffed animal. And that's enough if the parent or a loving caregiver is sitting with that child, reacting and talking to them the whole time. And so I wonder about the training of both the curriculum for the parents and for the staff. Do we focus in on one of those areas, reflective capacity, or do we focus in on another area around play? The last piece I wanted to not the last, I have many notes, but the other thing I wanted to underscore here is that reluctance to leave the child in those spaces comes up a lot. It's come up a lot in my own research where parents have significant histories. And I had a parent last fall sit with me and say, I know that she's in a shelter program. Shelter program has I believe it's an early head start or a childcare program attached to the shelter. So you just walk right through the door and it's right there. And she said, I know intellectually that is a really well-run program. I've met the staff. I know other residents who have their kids there, and it's a beautiful space. And I know that. And then she looked at me and she said, I can't do it. I can't leave my child there, and proceeded to tell me a lot about her trauma history and interpersonal violence and just the fear of that. And she said, I don't want to transmit that fear to my child. So right now we're just going to stay home, and we're going to stay here at the shelter, and we're going to do our own thing, but I'm working up to it. And she kind of like looked towards the program and looked back at me. She said, I'm working on it. I'm working on it. And I think when we talk about trauma-informed care and trauma-informed practices and what that looks like in the context of families, really making sure we're centering those family voices and those family experiences to really understand, practically speaking, what that means. Because I could see shelter staff saying, oh, she's just being difficult. She's not ready to let go of her babies, and really giving her a hard time about it. And I can also see staff saying, like, I get it. This is hard for you. You've been through some stuff. What can we do to support you? What can we do to help with that process? And really creating a space to have some of that, not even trauma-informed, but trauma-healing kinds of conversations. And that brings us back to staffing. How do you package the potato head person that has all of those skills? How do you bring all of that together? Because it's a really complex conversation in the midst of housing and employment and running a shelter and all of the things that go on for all of the residents in the context of all of those things. So it certainly is complex. I do think one area I am very interested in starting to explore, and I'm doing this already, is right now I'm about halfway through a training curriculum that we've developed on infant mental health for shelter staff. And so talking with shelter staff about what infant mental health is, that infants do have their own, they do have mental health, and that happens in the context of attachment relationships. And what does that look like? And how do you think about it for families in shelter, for families in recovery? How do you support that? How do you think about it for infants versus toddlers? Because I say toddlers are loud enough. They demand their own section of the curriculum of the workshop, which will happen soon. And so we're starting to, in a very small way, look at the effects of that. And so I'll keep you posted all on that intervention and that research, or on that training and that research, to see how it comes out. But so far, the response from shelter staff has been overwhelmingly positive. And it's a 5-6 part series we're doing online over the course of about six or eight months, in two cohorts with a large family program here in the Boston area. I'm seeing the chat box lighting up and I'm looking at my notes all at the same time. So I think what I'll do, we're going to have some time for conversation, I think, in a few minutes. So why don't I share, I'll share a little bit about some of the research I've done, because I think it complements a lot of this really, really well. Let's see here. There we go. Hopefully you can all see that just fine. So I put a few, I wasn't sure who would be here. I do think it's important to keep coming back to this. This is not a small issue in our country. 1 in 16 kids under 6 experience homelessness in the United States each year. And that's probably an undercount. And so this is a significant thing. We've talked all about this stuff here, so I'm going to skip, and I want to get right to just a little bit of research. And I think, Jeanette, I have maybe 5 or 7 minutes left.
Yeah, we've gone a little over. So please, I'm so excited to hear what you have to say. I also want to give Melissa a chance. Do you want to maybe go to Melissa for a few minutes and then we can come back to this? Would that be okay?
Oh, it's 10:50. I could share this another time.
All right, Melissa, please.
Thanks. Hi, everybody. So I am the social work trainer for the Homeless Health Initiative at CHOP. And what that means, because I don't think I have the best title name that explains what I do, but essentially I have been working with family shelters and a shelter for unaccompanied youth in Philly for 16 years through CHOP's Homeless Health Initiative. So we provide free on-site medical and dental care for kids who live in 3 sites in Philly. And then we provide other health and wellness programming for families who live in shelter. So we provide some programming for parents and some programming for children, and then somewhere the whole family is together. And I love that my job is really about relationship building and learning from staff and from families in shelter. I feel like that's a better title maybe for what I do is I soak up so much from families when they share their experiences, from staff. And then I get to create programming based on what we're hearing, and I get to deliver programming and tweak existing programming based on the people who are in front of us. And then I get to take what I've learned and what I'm still learning and share that with providers at CHOP. So doctors and nurses, every resident at CHOP, every doctor has to meet with me at least once a year during their residency to learn about family homelessness and how living in shelters impacts child health and development. And I think that, you know, Jeanette's, the work that she just presented and the paper, which I think everyone should ask for a copy of her paper, it really reflects what we've been hearing through the years and the things that I'm trying to share with our providers. So they're aware of how to support parents when they're parenting in shelter. You know, you have some parents who maybe have struggled with parenting before they moved into shelter. And then you have some parents who struggle with the new dynamics of parenting in shelter. And those are different. And sort of, you know, how to tease that out, how to support them, because I think for healthcare providers, you know, it can be scary to ask about where a family lives, because what do you do if the family says they live in shelter? Like how, and that's really my job, is equipping them with those tools, like how to ask these questions in a way that feels safe. And then what to do. And what are the, and honestly, it's like, ask more questions, right? Because even though I have worked for so long with so many families, no two families are the same. Families living in the same shelter at the same time can have very different experiences, whether, you know, they feel the shelter is supportive or not. So it's really learning from the person in front of you. You know, explaining the impact of trauma throughout the many stages of life, right? For our babies, for the kids, for the parents, what they're bringing to the table, how we can make sure that we're not making it worse for them. Just thinking about, you know, asking a lot of questions about the physical environment in shelter. So are there, similar to some of the questions you were asking, are there play spaces for kids? Or are there spaces that are safe and clean to put your baby down on the floor so they can, you know, practice tummy time, so they can crawl? We know, and this is something, again, we, you know, trying to build some sensitivity around, a lot of our kids are in strollers when they're inside the shelter. And I don't want people to get judgmental about that, right? It's not as simple as, oh, we need to teach mom to take her baby out of the stroller. Like, mom is actually making a really smart decision keeping her baby in that stroller. So how do we find other ways and other opportunities to support motor development, right? And getting them out of the stroller and finding these safe spaces for that. You know, how clean is the environment too? If we have kids who are constantly sick, I talk to parents who can't work because the more kids they have, the higher the likelihood that they're going to miss a lot of work because of illness, right? And when you're living with a lot of people, things tend to spread very quickly. And any illness spreads quickly, right? We do a lot of work around just helping to promote breastfeeding and the normalization of breastfeeding, because it really does, you know, when you sort of look at the risk factors, it was like one of Jeanette's first slides, but like some risk factors for kids and then the benefits of breastfeeding, so much is really counteracted by just breastfeeding, right? Like the physical benefits of that, but also just that bond that it really helps create between the parent and child is so helpful. I think that, you know, when I think about how we support children in shelter, I always go back to the adults, right? Because we can't just focus on, like, it's great to have resources that we can connect children to, but we need to take care of the adults first. So if we're not taking care of the parents, if we're not taking care of staff, they will have nothing to give those kids. We can give them all of the most helpful resources and, you know, great information. But if they don't have the bandwidth to do anything with that, if they feel overwhelmed, if they don't know where to start, if making that phone call is the hardest part, like those are the things that we really need to be helpful. And that's what we try to do. So I think even thinking about Laura, I love the potato head visual. And I guess I would argue, instead of putting all of the, you know, arms and legs and eyes on one potato head, let's get lots of potato heads around. Like, we just need more potato heads, right? And I, again, I'm sensitive to staff workload too. They shouldn't be the be all and end all for families, right? We shouldn't be making them experts in anything outside of how do you care for the people who are living? That is the number one thing I hear from families when they have the best experience, whether it's around food or just support, it's always love. I swear to you, every time someone has said, like, I actually enjoy the food this person makes, which is rare, they have always said it's because she made it with love. And when they feel love and they feel connection. And we know this from child development, right? Like, that's what kids need from their parents is connection. If you can take 5 minutes in a day to just focus on your kid, you can make the rest of your day so much better, the rest of their day so much better. And I think it's the same with staff. So how do we support staff? Give them some basics. I do think for sure we need to create environments. Emergency shelters are supposed to be emergency placements. It's supposed to be short term. Unfortunately, it's not as short as we would want it to be, right? So how can we provide some just overall guidance to help staff build that capacity to care for kids, to connect with parents, to model positive parenting, right? Because that's really tricky. I have been in some uncomfortable situations with staff sort of overstepping and taking on a parent's role. And I can't imagine being in that situation and trying to navigate that, how awful that feels for everybody. And I think that staff have the best intentions, right? But it's what tools do they have? So, you know, if we can bring in, the other thing is we have a limited time with families, right? So in all of our programming, we're really trying to, we get in there, we're trying to provide some service with, you know, whoever shows up that will feel helpful for them, but always, 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 we're trying to connect them back to other people in the community. Because we don't know if they'll be there tomorrow, if we have a couple of months with them. So I think, you know, making sure that we do have, and that's where these types of forums are really important, because, you know, you start to learn about all of the different resources out there and connecting with people who are doing different work to support families in different ways. And I think that's the best way that we can really foster connection, you know, across all the adults who are really touching the lives of kids. And I'll stop now. I'm sorry.
Hey, if I could jump in real quick, fantastic and incredible conversation. We can continue. Zoom's not going to kick us off, but for those who do have to leave at 11 o'clock, we understand. But as long as people want to have this conversation, we can keep going. Jeanette, back to you.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks so much, Melissa and Katie and Laura, for sharing, you know, all of those ideas and bringing so many pieces to the conversation. Like, these are themes that come up again and again in this conference and in this work. And I know that a lot of our brains and our hearts are working hard on these things, and they're challenging things. So like Joe said, you know, we are at 11. So those of you who need to scoot, feel free. But I certainly can stick around a little longer. So if anybody would like to ask questions or share more thoughts that we haven't heard from yet, please let us know. Also, Joe, I already invited Katie to co-present with me when I come back. So she's going to come in, back with some of her own data when we talk about infant data.
I do want to see that. Yeah, I do.
Yeah. Sorry, Katie, that we had to cut you off. I was telling everyone, oh, take your time, take your time. And then we all took too much time.
No problem. I was like on the edge of my seat listening to yours and Laura's presentation. This has been so interesting.
Yeah, so maybe January or February of next month, as was in the chat. Thank you, Edie. Kim Prendergast from the ABC project will be coming in talking about their work and how they interact with the early intervention system. ABC is attachment and biobehavioral catch-up, an evidence-based program that's being offered to parents in shelter. Comments, questions?
I did have a comment. In the original presentation, we heard about families in rural areas staying in motels. And I think that we have to, again, differentiate between the different types of shelter that families with young children are in. And I think that, yes, they still need it. You know, they still need some sort of intervention in motels. So I would recommend that. I also heard that EI in the chat is available to everyone who is homeless. I need to say EI varies considerably between states and within states, between counties who get allocated, you know, who get assigned to do the EI. And the issue of being homeless and asking for services isn't always smooth. So I really think we need to look at how EI works in the homeless delivery system. Those are the two that jumped out at me. And then, a third one was that staff asked for training in development. How did that lead to parents needing training in development? Okay. It was
no, this is
oh,
so
we're not talking about the training for the folks who work with families. We ended up with having to do training for parents in parenting. And
okay, can I just respond to that real quick? Just with some other things we have thought about, because I am so with you on that. And it is so funny. Whenever I bring the survey and these workshops to an audience, people think I'm talking about parents. It's like, it is so automatic that we say we've got to educate the parents, educate the parents, educate the parents. And I think, you know, I know that Katie and I have talked about this, and Laura and Melissa and I and Sarah Ravick and I and Joe, and we're all talking about this thing where it's like, you know, it's true that some parents have things they need to learn. And usually they know that, right? Like the parents who don't know what they're doing, they know they don't know what they're doing. And that's really scary for them. But there are also a lot of parents who actually, they get it. They really do. And what they need is someone to have their back, right? And they need the support. And they need to know that when I'm doing what I know is best for my child, the people around me are going to give me space and empathy for how hard that can be. And so I agree, you know, our workshops are for staff, right? And we're trying to say, we can absolutely, let's keep reaching out to parents. Let's provide parenting support, because the parents want that too, right? We hear that consistently. And I know in North Carolina, you hear that, right? Parents do want support and help around that. But a lot of what they need comes from putting other supportive people around them, right? And not assuming that it's all on them to do it right and do it perfectly, while they're also getting jobs and improving their educational background and breaking ties with negative people in their lives and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I 100% hear you. And I think we can't say that enough.
I don't want to dominate, but I have another one. Just backing up way before they get to shelter, and that whole issue of unstable housing and the doubled up Parents with young children often double up or motel before they ever get into the shelter system. And so I think we need to look at what's happening. Where are they staying? I would love to see more doubled up research. Are they? And there is some good stuff out there to start with, but there's very little. And I really think we need to know if they're staying with grandparents. Is that a good thing or is that a bad thing? How do we support that? Not every doubled up situation is a problem. And some are solutions. So I would really love to see us, you know, preventing homeless shelter for families.
I'd love to see preventing homeless shelter for families, but I'd also love to see what's happening with families when they're turned away from shelter. So, I mean, currently I have three families I'm serving who've been turned away day after day after day with young children. It's like, and they're finding somewhere to sleep with their kids. I mean, and that's counting against them for getting into the supports that they need because it's a really threatening system. I mean, I had a mom yesterday tell me, I'm not going to tell anyone the truth about where I'm staying because I believe the shelter system, they're already DHS involved too. And like, I don't think they can go beyond, like you're already having like interaction and DHS isn't necessarily supporting that too, to getting you into the shelter, but they definitely told you, you had to leave your primary residence or your child would be removed. It's just sort of, a lot of families will choose to stay out of shelter as long as they can. But for families that can't, we need to know what's going on in the spaces where they are working to get there and to offer supports in that intermediate period while families are waiting to get the services that they need.
Anybody else?
Yeah, to build on.
Sir, I'm sorry. Could you introduce yourself?
Yeah, so I'm JJ Catrulli. I'm a researcher at Nemours Children's Health, and to underscore the complicated problem that Erin just raised with respect to real valid fears about child protection services. Mm-hmm. I can say in Philadelphia, we've had a few discussions with DHS that oversees both prevention services for child welfare and child protection. And, the execution is whatever it is. And so I'm not blazing in to defend DHS, but I can say the conversations I've had, there's a real I guess I'll call it a desire or a willingness or a commitment to help everyone from providers through parents understand that homelessness is not necessarily cause to engage a child protection case, or it's not neglect, it's not maltreatment, so long as, you know, other standards are met, right? And more my reason for speaking is to just say that there's also a real commitment on the prevention side of child welfare to understand how their services help families who are experiencing homelessness and how they can do more or do better. And they're very interested in understanding the largest part of their prevention dollars, as far as the subsidies that they grant, goes to rental assistance and housing issues. And so we've got this other agency that's very interested in housing issues, given their multiple roles in prevention and child welfare. I think a lot of it is a question of getting everyone to the table and talking and coordinating and figuring out kind of how to make this all work better and best, right? And so it's difficult work. It's the hard work, but at least I'm feeling the love that folks are willing to come to the table.
I just also, since people are still here, I just want to share one more thing that I've been hearing from parents that I do think is really important is they're really looking for these opportunities for programming for their kids. They really want, and I do think, you know, in this, like, we're getting closer to what shelters were doing before COVID now than ever before. I do think that really messed up a lot of things, even just, you know, bringing in outside programming like ours. But I think that's always really nice too, is when we can promote those relationships between shelters and other agencies and groups in the community who can bring those services in. So again, we're not asking staff to create these programs themselves, but like, who can you bring in to do this? So, you know, we will go to a shelter and play with kids for an hour. Like, that is our program. It's a bunch of volunteers who run around with the kids. It's fun for the kids. It gives them a little bit of exercise, gets rid of some of their, uses up a little bit of their energy. They have endless energy, but gives the parents a break too, just for an hour where they can just do nothing. They can get something done. They can just breathe, you know, whatever they have to do. And they're not responsible for little people for an hour. And what I've heard from parents is that the more programming that's available for kids, the better the relationships between the kids are. Because when you have 50 kids who are living in this space together and they're bored, bad things are going to happen, right? Like, it's just like siblings, like you're going to get on each other's nerves. You know how to push each other's buttons. You're going to get into mischief. So if we can provide opportunity, and again, I think it's great to have spaces where parents can use it with their kids. But I think if we can also give parents some breaks and provide programming for kids, that will help them too. You know, part of our play is like we try to sneak in some like lessons about playing together nicely and, you know, cooperation and team building and taking turns and those things to sort of help build some of those skills for our kids too.
I just want to say this is the best meeting I've had all week.
This was really wonderful. It was so nice to hear from everyone. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Anything else? Some great stuff. Well, ma'am, it doesn't stop here. Let's continue talking. We'll be back next November, taking off in December, but then pick up again for this event on in January. And of course, a lot of us are interacting with each other all the time. I shamelessly put in the link to the Substack writings that Jeanette, Grace Whitney, Tracy Duarte, myself, JJ, and a few others are contributing to. It talks about all things kids from, you know, actually prenatal to age 24. So feel free to contribute and certainly read. Because if no one's going to talk about homeless kids other than us, well, if we don't talk about homeless kids, who is, right? We got to keep telling the policymakers and the general public out there about the lives of our kids and all.
The letters have been great, by the way. I've been sharing them far and wide, and they're so easy to understand, digestible, and shareable that it like really is incredibly helpful to the advocacy work I'm doing to have something that backs it up and sort of like, and here's a bunch of numbers. So thanks to everyone contributing to those.
Yeah, and thanks, Joe, for making this happen.
Thank you, guys. I mean, few people love data except all the people in this group here. So we might be talking to the choir, but it's you know, the work moves so fast that we miss a lot of stuff, right? And hopefully the Substack articles or a column or a social media thing, whatever it's called, helps us to stay connected, have information at our fingertips, and we know where to go to when we need some deeper dives into the work. I believe my colleague Malkia had to hop off. So let's get on with our rest of the day and have a great weekend, everybody. I appreciate everybody for coming on, and look forward to continue our working together. All right.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.